The Ducks may be on a bye, but a lot happened in sports-wise here in our state. Let's hit on a few items with the fine sports journal for the Oregonian. After covering the Lakers for the OC Register, he's back home. Online, visit OregonLive.com. On Twitter, the handle is at Bill Orem. Bill, how's life treating you to the north there?
It's great up here. We got a beautiful blue sky day and starting to feel like fall up here, Steve. So it's nice. You know, the skies are blue and things are happening with the WNBA and a lot of energy around Portland.
I'm sure. We have nice blue skies here, but we've got college basketball, Bill. So you were at the event. WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert, a lot of others announcing this new franchise, Senator Wyden, texts from Sabrina Ionescu. I was a lot of cheering for a press conference. What was the vibe like? Because, man, Bill, it seemed very joyful and uplifting.
Well, it was, Steve, and, you know, there's been a long a long runway here to get this team in Portland. I mean, obviously, just the last year or two kind of fits and starts. It was expected to happen last fall before the ownership group kind of fell apart right at the finish line. And so then it was back to the drawing board, and two new groups came together. It was obviously the Bethal family that won the bid, which, you know, obviously makes sense given their connections to the city, the ownership they have of the Thorns. But, I mean, there have been a lot of people who have missed the Portland Fire over these last 22 years. You know, some people have asked, well, why is the WNBA going to work here when it didn't work before? It did work. It was that team had averaged 8,500 fans per game.
Wow.
You know, which maybe isn't a lot by, you know, NBA standards, but for the WNBA kind of in its, you know, nascent years, stood out and frankly would have been successful attendance numbers in the NBA recently. There was always an enthusiasm for the women's game in Portland for the WNBA, and I would expect, you know, that to pick right up. So I think it was wise of the league to look back to Portland, obviously recognizing the huge success that the Portland Thorns have had. The Thorns, you know, the soccer team has had, has led the league in attendance right up into the arrival of Angel City in L.A. and the Wave down in San Diego, which have, you know, obviously, you know, kind of knocked it out of the park. But, you know, Portland has been at the forefront of the women's sports movement over the last, you know, 12, 15 years. And now they get a piece of the basketball movement as well.
No, I thought the interview with Jackie Stiles, who was like, she echoed your sentiments, Bill. She was like, don't act like we didn't have support. It wasn't a failure.
Yeah.
It was elsewhere. You mentioned the ownership, the Bethal family, who bought the Thorns after that sleazathon with Merritt Paulson. They own part of the NBA Kings. So for folks just catching up, what could you tell us about them? Because, as you mentioned, they obviously have strong ties right there in the community.
Well, they've developed them quickly is what I would say. And, you know, obviously this is a family that didn't make its money in Portland. The family's history is in swimwear. The dad, Raj, got it going, but the two kids, right? I mean, it feels funny calling them kids, but
right.
Alex Bethal and his sister Lisa Bethal Mirage, they have jumped into the capital space. They have their own fund, Raj Capital, named after their dad, and they've expanded that portfolio to include sports. I mean, along with their dad, they're part of the ownership group of the Sacramento Kings that came in with Vivek Ranadive. I want to say 2013 or 14. Obviously, NBA valuations have exploded in the decade since then, and you know they've bought in on the women's sports front. Obviously, the Thorns situation presented itself when Merritt Paulson finally acknowledged that he needed to step out of the way and let somebody else be stewards of the Thorns. I think that there's, and it was interesting. Lisa Bethal Mirage talked at the press conference about being sold on women's sports and really discovering that at a Thorns game when she saw the passion for the Thorns. And, obviously they're not an unknown commodity in basketball circles. They're known within the NBA's board of governors. And obviously the NBA is, you know, a major investor of the WNBA. And so I think that helps their case as well. But, you know, they're excited and serious about making this a success. They have, you know, basically 18 months to do it, a little over 18 months before this team would start playing. So there's a lot to work out in the next year and a half.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting talking with Bill Orem, the Oregonian. And, of course, Bill, the true issue, what are we going to call them? I loved your article. The fire seems bad with wildfires in our state.
Sure.
I liked your suggestion of the mist, maybe the old ABL name, the power. You have a favorite, a hint, or how is this going to end up getting decided? Because you know people are going to lose their mind and sell out the gear in like 45 minutes.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what they come up with. Obviously, selfishly, I want one of the names I came up with to be the winner. I put about 40 of them in a single column, so you got to think I'm at least close on one of them. You know, there's just so many ways you can go with it. Do you want it to be a continuation of the rose theme? Feels like that has a chance, considering the Bethals also own the Thorns, so is there another rose name? The Roses feels too obvious, and doesn't quite do the trick for me. You know, I suggested the pistols, you know, as being a part of a flower, probably wouldn't happen. But you know, some of my favorite ones are a little more goofy, maybe too goofy for what you know, Portland's looking for. I like the on the rose front, I like the Portland Perennials.
That's
because
not
it suggests
bad.
That
That's
they'll be back
bad.
Year after year. I did suggest the Portland Summers, because everyone knows Portland Summers are undefeated. And I also happen to like the Portlandia Trident, because if you've been on Fifth Avenue in Portland, you look up, you see that big copper sculpture of Portlandia, the symbol of Portland, and she's got a giant trident in her hand. So the Portlandia Trident also jumps out at me. But I do think, you know, this is a city of, you know, obviously very progressive ideals, and the sort of moment we're in culturally, the sort of emphasis on women's sports and sort of the push for women's sports and you know, eyes on women's sports. I think something a little more aspirational makes sense. You know, the Portland Propel came to mind. The Portland. You know, the Portland Pride was an indoor soccer team. I mean, I could go on and on, Steve. I've got 40 of them. So if, the longer we go, I'll just eventually name them all off. But I think something like the Portland Propel could be a winner as well.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how deep they're willing to go, or if they just try to resurrect something. All right, let's move to college football. By the way, kudos on the first ever Pac-6 ranking with the announcement last week. So the bottom line is, after getting the rug pulled out starting in June of 2022 when UCLA and USC made their announcement, now you got OSU and Washington State announced the Mountain West schools coming to the league. I'm kind of curious as to your take on, you know, reviving the Pac and what's next, who they might target, because they've got to get to 8 to really sustain.
It's going to be really interesting, Steve, and you know, there's a lot of common sense to this, right? I mean, the schools that Oregon State and Washington State targeted are the most valuable football brands in the Mountain West Conference. Boise State, Colorado State, Fresno State, and San Diego State. You may have forgotten, but San Diego State has had 5-10-win seasons in the last decade.
Right.
So there's been a lot of, you know, on-field success in the Mountain West among these four schools. I think as you move forward, you want to continue that. You want to have the fifth best football conference in the FBS. That's kind of the goal here. So you're looking eastward, and you've heard obviously Memphis and Tulane as really popular names. Those are both schools that were mentioned as possible additions in terms of saving the Pac-12 before it completely fell apart. You'll remember in 2023, after Colorado left and the conference was down to 9, and there were questions of, well, how do you get back to 12? What is the goal? You know, San Diego State was always, you know, a slam dunk, but there were a lot of people talking about Tulane is a potential addition. SMU is a potential addition. Tulane and Memphis make sense. Those are schools that kind of open up the geography of the conference and also have had a ton of football success. But they're going to have competition. Obviously, the American is going to want to keep them. The American is trying to grow, wants to bring in Air Force, which would all obviously be even worse for the Mountain West. But, you know, I also think there's the question of Texas. Do you put a priority on getting into Texas? UTSA is a bit of a rocket ship right now, as is Texas State down in San Marcos. It was an FCS program 15 years ago, but Texas State is growing rapidly and is really well resourced. So it's a little speculative, but I could see that being an option depending on what happens with kind of the first choice schools. And then the other thing I'll add is, you know, I was among those who was surprised that UNLV was not in the initial round of expansion and or like expansion, resurrection, whatever you want to call it. And I just think that there is no world where UNLV ends up not being a part of this. It makes too much sense. UNLV obviously has a mass, Las Vegas as a market is a huge center of the Western U.S. in terms of sports and really everything else right now. I think the Pac-12 wants to be in Vegas. I just don't see a scenario where this doesn't end with them ending up in the Pac-12 unless another conference comes in and poaches them away first. UNLV, obviously a great basketball tradition and seems to finally be pointed in the right direction football-wise. So those five schools, I think you're going to see some combination of those five joining the Pac-12. Could it be all five of them? And I wouldn't rule that out, but I think that might be getting a little big for this initial round. I think 8 or 9 schools is more likely.
Man, thinking of Vegas as a NFL, MLB, NHL town, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when that wasn't even feasible. But I wanted to get to what you and Nick Daschle wrote about, kind of this ongoing rivalry between the Ducks and Beavers. They will play again next season, and then who knows? So you guys wrote about it. What are the factors and numbers that exist, which may add up to maybe an extended hiatus in this series?
Yeah, I think extended, it kind of depends on your perspective. I mean, it's been such a long, uninterrupted series that any break feels, like a loss. But you look at this at Oregon's schedule after 2025, they're booked. They have 3 non-conference opponents each of those 3 years, 26, 27, 28. And you might say, well, hey, you bought out games, you moved games around, you sent Texas Tech to Pullman, why not just do that for those years? Well, budget's going to be tighter at Oregon and across college football after this year, assuming the house ruling is implemented. Schools are going to need to find up to $22 million in their budget to compensate athletes. And even at a place like Oregon, which we think of as having golden toilets on every floor, there's real budgetary demands, and the idea of finding $22 million that isn't going to be additionally funded. I mean, you might get some of it from the university, but you're not getting, you're not going to get a plus $22 million to cover this. The idea of saying, well, now you also have to spend another $2.5 million to move games around to accommodate Oregon State. Is that realistic? Is that a realistic ask on top of the $22 million they already need to find? So that's something that Nick and I were watching. Obviously, there's always a way to get it done. Scott Barnes has been who's the AD at Oregon State has been part of things like this before. He was the AD at Pitt when they resurrected the backyard brawl with West Virginia, and what he told Nick was, when there's a will, there's a way. Obviously, Oregon State wants to keep this going. It's good for Oregon State. Obviously, I mean, if you saw the game on Saturday, I mean, there were butts in the seats, and that's something the Beavers are going to really need as they move into this new era. So having a home-and-home ongoing into the future with the Ducks is huge for the Beavers. But, if you had a 3-year break in that series, who knows exactly what the nature of that rivalry looks like after a little time apart, and do both sides still want to continue it into perpetuity after that? I think it's at least worth monitoring.
I believe Tennessee called it a 10% increase, a talent fee. The final thing I want to get to is back to Reaser last week after a first half that was tight. Oregon just put the hammer down. It was a big improvement over the Idaho schools. So did the Ducks find some key answers in between those games? Could it be that the Beavers are not very good? What did you make of 49-14, you know, the romp from the Duck angle?
I think both things are probably a little bit true, Steve. I mean, the Beavers are better than they looked against the Ducks, and they're not going to play another team like Oregon this year. That said, I mean, the Beavers have some problems. It kind of turned into a get-right game for the Ducks, which is sort of what you expect from an FCS opponent, frankly. But it was just good to see the Ducks firing on all cylinders, because they had not had that at all this year. And to see them go ahead and score on 8 straight drives, you know, you can say it was close in the first half, and I know the Beavers were, you know, technically within reach at halftime, but they couldn't stop Oregon. They couldn't stop Dylan Gabriel at all. Dylan Gabriel, you know, was nearly perfect through the air. Obviously got the big one with his legs. You know, to me, that game was essentially over when Oregon State missed that field goal on the opening drive. Or more realistically, it was over when Oregon State committed a false start on 4th and 1, you know, when they were driving, because the Beavers couldn't afford, the Beavers' game plan was to dominate time of possession and run the ball. And they couldn't afford to come up empty on any of those drives, because they, you know, you're trying to keep the ball out of Oregon's offense's hands. And once they came up empty on that drive and the Ducks, you know, showed they were going to be able to slice through the defense like a warm knife through butter, the Beavers were essentially done, in my opinion.
Yeah, it reminded me of some of those powerhouse Chip Kelly teams when the opponent felt like, we better keep up or we're dead. And yeah, it didn't happen. Folks, he's Bill Oram. Catch all the terrific coverage and writing and stories and thoughts online for the Oregonian. Visit OregonLive.com. You can link it all on Twitter. Use the handle at Bill Oram. Bill, always great having you. Always enjoy our conversations. You be well. And, of course, look forward to running into you at Autzen real soon.
I think that sounds great. We'll see you, Steve.
All right, take it easy.